With great excitement, I welcome you to this Calvary Baptist Church service. I'm Pastor John Jenks. This particular service is part of an intense series from the book of Daniel. Through this book, Jesus teaches us how to live in a place where people do not acknowledge him, and they seem all powerful in their surroundings. Daniel proves that God is in control and will guide us through our very similar godless culture. The prophecies of Daniel to date have come true, and the next ones may be about to happen. It kind of makes you sit up and take notice. I hope these messages, because of this, help you strengthen your faith. I hope they help your faith to form. Daniel, and we're jumping back into the Daniel series. Some of you have been around here a while say, I thought Pastor John lost two chapters in his Bible. No, we're going to finish this Daniel series because it would be a travesty not to, okay, because of what's in the last couple of chapters. So find your way to Daniel 11. But I'm telling you, if I was Daniel singing that song, and he could, he had words like that in the Psalms that I'm sure he spoke to himself. Because if you think about his circumstances, my goodness, you know, the loss of family, the loss of all his faith structure, you know, temple and all that stuff gone. The loss of finances. I mean, he was from the king's house and he became poor and slavery, loss of freedom. He had no control personally of his life the rest of his days. Loss of freedom. He lost pretty much everything that we would hold dear. He even lost the potential for fatherhood as he became a eunuch. I mean, the list goes on and on. I've only spoken about half that I did in that first sermon. So we think about this hero of the Jewish people as they were introduced to him in this book from God. And the book of Daniel, it's a stellar book. You remember, it's written both to Jews because some of the chapters, like chapter 1 and the last four chapters, are all in the Hebrew language. But the middle chapters, chapters 2 through 7, were written in the language of the day. And they were written specifically in the language of the day so that the people of the day would have to grapple with who God was. And they did. Matter of fact, one of them, Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, a ruling king of the day. Really, you'd say the most powerful man on earth writes praise and worship to the one true almighty God in the book of Daniel. I mean, it's a stellar book. And if you haven't been here for the whole series, it's available online. You can catch up and read and be immersed in what God has given in his book. A book that was supposed to buoy the souls of the Jewish people as they went back to the land. God had written it down, and it wasn't even completed until they were already on their way back. And as they went back to be able to see these truths and be able to exist in the midst of what was going to be continual chaos around them as God's people. We look at these chapters and we come to that idea of chaos. And I've put this statement in front of you today to think about the comfort of control in chaos. And what do I mean by that? Well, for our family, a number of years ago, one of our children was sick and had been sick for 17 days. And had lost well over 10% of his body mass, and we're looking at him as a little skinny kid anyway, going, this is not good. And the doctors couldn't figure out what's wrong, and finally the last doctor we were at said, you really should go see some doctor that's kind of like this, good luck. And I went, what? Good luck? Like, help us, get help. You know, I was like devastated because to me, this is chaos. My kid is sick. And I had no comfort there, right? A few days later, we get to this other doctor, and they work through some things, and they figure out what's wrong, and begin to have a plan and an attack point, and our comfort as a family returned. And I'm here to tell you, that's loony, okay? It is how we function as people. Was our son healed at that point? No. Did we know if he'd live four more years? No. I don't know if I'm living tomorrow. I don't know about you. But in some way, in the midst of chaos, sometimes the chaos gets so big that we're just troubled. But if we get a couple of little pieces that we sort of think we can make sense with and hold together and follow as a process, all of a sudden we have comfort. And I'm here to tell you, do not rely on that kind of comfort. What Daniel's written for is that we might have comfort in God's control amidst the chaos. All right, the longer I study Daniel, I begin to think, you know what? I don't know if there really is chaos.
And you'll have to look at this chapter and see if you agree with me. I'm not sure there is chaos. I mean, there's things that happen that are really evil and wrong and bubble up all around us. But the bottom line is God is in such control. How could you even call that chaos? Because he's control. Our comfort needs to be from God in the midst of chaos. Daniel certainly gave that example in his personal life and the things he walked through. And as he's finishing his life and finishing Daniel, the book, you see this. He's in his 80s as you get to chapter 10, which we talked about a number of weeks ago. And at the end of chapter 10, you remember, he's in this chapter 10 where he's seen a vision. Matter of fact, someone who looks like a man has met with him by the river and given him this vision. And he is so troubled by the future that he sees that he falls down. He can't even move. He's overcome. And you might say, well, he's an old guy. I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think it had to do with how troublesome the future was that was shown to him. I mean, he'd lived his whole life with trouble. He had just watched, right before chapter 10 and 11, watched the people of Israel begin to be sent back by Cyrus to build the temple and rebuild Jerusalem. So he's seeing God keep his word yet again that was promised in Isaiah, where Cyrus was named 150 years before he's born. And he's watching the hand of God and the control of God unfold right in front of him in stellar ways. And yet when he sees vision of future things that are about to come, he is shaken. And God comes, sends his messenger to meet personally with Daniel. He so loved Daniel. And he said this, it was at the end of chapter 10, if you remember, in verse 19, he says, and he said, O man greatly loved, fear not. Could there be anything better to come from God to you than for God to look at you and say, oh, you greatly loved, don't fear. And God's telling him, I sent this messenger. He fought his way through the demonic forces. And I know all of that troubles you, but he said he fought his way through. He's given you this message. He's going back to fight. And God's vision and plan is going to happen. Think about, and I don't want to fast forward to New Testament times, our times too quickly in this sermon, but I just say, has not God looked at us as those who believed and called us the ones that he loves? Hasn't he done that? He told us, and I've not given you a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. So remember, in the midst of what looks like chaos, we have that same intimate connection with God where he's looking at us and he's saying, I love you. As a matter of fact, I'm actively loving you. You need not fear. So Daniel comes out of this vision and being stabilized by the messenger from God and being loved intimately by God, and he enters what we call chapter 11, and he gives resolve to King Darius. And it says, at the beginning of that chapter, he says that it's in the first year of Darius the Mede. And as we've studied this book, there's a lot of history. Matter of fact, this chapter, I cannot begin to explain all the history, partly because I barely can keep it all straight in my own head. Okay, because there's so much of it that's going to be covered in this chapter. But I'll give some overview, give some explanation. Darius is Cyrus. They're the same person. You say, but chapter 10 was in the third year. Now he's coming and speaking as if it's the first year. How does this work? Well, he's called Cyrus in chapter 10 because he's talking about who he is as it relates to Persia. But when he labels him Darius, he's talking about the fact that he's only ruled where Daniel is for 1 year. And he uses the local title for that. That's how you make those two things go together. Plus, Daniel's about to tell him things aren't good for Persia. And so he uses his local name, and he's trying to, I'm trying to stabilize. I'm going to show you the truth. I'm going to stand up, confirm, and strengthen Darius. Why would he want to strengthen Darius? Because Darius was fulfilling what Isaiah said and sending the people back to the land. And there was all kinds of demonic forces against that. Can't you imagine why? Because if the people don't go back to the land under Cyrus, then God's a liar. And Isaiah is false prophecy, and you might as well toss the whole Bible. And so there's great war at this. And so Daniel's saying to Darius, don't be worried. This is in God's hands. Matter of fact, let me give you the vision. Let me give you how big God's hand is and how much he's going to control. And really, this chapter in the Bible is unlike any other chapter in its completeness, the intensity that's here. Verse 2, he says, and I'll show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia. So we have Cyrus, and he says, there are going to be three more, and then a fourth. And that fourth, if I was labeling him, is Xerxes, if you look at the historical record. And that fourth king, Xerxes the first, shall be far richer than all of the other kings. So he's going to surpass Cyrus and the others. And he says, and when he's become strong through his riches, he will stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. And you could go back in history and recount how Xerxes raised one of the largest armies of all times and in ships tried to do battle with Greece and lost and retreated back to Persia and was never again the same kind of powerful leader. Matter of fact, the scales of power tipped. And it wasn't that long after that that you get to verse 3. So you see laying it out. Now, why does God put history like this in the Bible? Well, in Daniel in particular, Daniel's unique in this way. We have record of the book of Daniel being complete and being read before you get to Xerxes. And what that means is this prophecy that's laid out, none of it, I mean, it's proven in historical record that none of it was written later, okay? Some people have said of Isaiah and the book, or the chapter that I mentioned about Cyrus, that someone put that name in later, which I don't believe, because it doesn't follow. Isaiah, we know, was read long before. But we have even more proof of how Daniel was read and how it was in complete form before any of the things in chapter 11 happened. And I'm here to tell you, there's a long list of things that happened in chapter 11. All of which God laid down ahead of time, all of which have come true to this point, that make you, I mean, you just have to step back and go, I think we better believe the Bible. I mean, that's really what this chapter does, which gives us, you're going to find out before we're done, comfort in chaos, because we have a message from God that can direct our steps when life around us makes no sense. This is just the tip of the iceberg in talking about Xerxes. Then you come to verse 3 and it says, then after Xerxes, a mighty king shall arise. We would know him in history as Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And he did. I mean, he galloped across the known world. It's being written about and understood by Daniel and others, and took complete control while he's still in his 30s. And it says, as soon as he's arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. This absolutely happened in this way. Alexander died young in his 30s. His own child died. The kingdom was never given to his son. Instead, it was divided between his generals, and none of them ever had combined together power like Alexander. The kingdom never expanded. It just became four little kingdoms that continued to divide, attack each other, have alliances and intrigue and debauchery, and it was just a mess. And then eventually Rome took over. It's a perfect picture of what happened after Alexander the Great. And now you have this section in this chapter that I'm actually not going to teach because there's so much history back to back to back, and unless you're really up on the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and all this other stuff, you'd go, Pastor John, I lost you about three people ago, okay? Because it has that much. But I've read two different explanations, historically speaking, and they both agree. Matter of fact, most all of the writers of history would agree that this matches perfectly, and they can lay it out. And they agree on which king and what happened and which queen was married to which other kingdom, and so they had some kind of power and how it divided, and you can read how it unfolds in this chapter. They actually agree. They agree on this chapter all the way to verse 36. Pretty much all historians agree on the content, which is kind of amazing in and of itself, that they agree that, yep, the way this lays out fits with these people. They agree on it. It's that clear, and it's that specific in how it lays out. This section, though, I have to at least say this, that it is, the Greece was divided into four kingdoms, and if you read the next section, you see, but there's only two kingdoms talked about. There's the North Kingdom and the South Kingdom, but that's because the Northern Kingdom was like Syria and a little bit of Palestine and kind of above that, and the Southern Kingdom was Egypt and some surrounding territories. So what's in between Syria and Egypt? If you smash them together, what's right in the middle? Israel. That's right, Palestine. And so the reason that Daniel writes these two is because, remember, Daniel's writing to the Jewish people. He's writing to the Jewish people who are going to be in the sandwich, okay? They're going to be in the middle having to deal with the impact of these two Grecian kingdoms that are stomping back and forth across Palestine. And it's going to be a miserable time for Daniel. He lived his whole life faithfully, unfolded truth, and knew the history and the prophecy of Cyrus sending the people back to the land. And so I think for many years in his life, until visions like this, he must have thought, I can endure because one day the kingdom of Israel is going to be reestablished and it'll be an eternal kingdom. And that's the parts he could see from the history and the prophecy he already had. And so he's living for that. This is why this is so troubling, because now God is filling in the blanks and telling them, yes, that the kingdom's going to be reestablished and it's going to have very little power. And it's going to get smushed. And it's going to be hard. But that wasn't the end of the story. If God didn't open this up this way, as a Jewish person, you would have, as you lived through this or died through this, you would have been ready to dismiss God. So it's actually a great kindness that God unfolds horrifically troubling events. And these events continue to walk back and forth across Palestine. And maybe I teach one thing out of this section. If you look at verse 14, it says, as the king of the north comes down one more time and is attacking the king of the south, it says, in those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. What is he saying? Well, he's talking about the Jewish people. He's talking about Jewish people that were in Egypt. And as the king of the north comes down, they're ready to throw off the southern kingdom, this ruler in Egypt that they can't stand who's oppressing them. And so they rebel in an attempt to help the king of the north. And instead, they absolutely lose. Now, this is one of those stories in the Bible that make you scratch your head, except that we're kind of the same way. I mean, these were Jewish people. They are not called people of the covenant, so there must be kind of rebellious Jewish people, okay, living in Egypt. And you would think they had access to Daniel. I mean, it was written and passed around. They had access to Daniel. They could have read, a group down in the south rise up, and they're going to get squished. I mean, if you knew you were going to lose, would you fight? I don't think so. So it shows that they're kind of rebellious. I always think it's funny that rebellious people say, well, God, whatever. And then God uses them to absolutely fulfill what he's written down. It's just kind of a ironic, you know, kind of snicker, if you will. And that's exactly what happened. That's just one point of history that happened exactly as was spoken. At the end of this section in verse 20, it says, then shall arise in his place, this is in the north, one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. In other words, he's this king of the north, he's been defeated, he's had a retreat, he's back up in the north, he's got to pay for all his campaigns, and so he sends someone that brings brutal taxes on the land of Palestine. And it talks about this king of the north setting up the next king. And he says he's going to send this exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he'll be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. In other words, he's not going to fight on a battlefield. Someone's not going to stab. What happens? Well, he actually dies of poisoning. And they don't even know who poisoned him. Some people assume it's the next king that we're about to hear about, but they don't know for sure. Just out of nowhere, he's poisoned. Absolutely keeping the prophecy. Then we come to the next section, the one that should catch our eyes, because it's the little horn from earlier in Daniel, where there were the four horns that came up out of the one beast, and then another horn came up and broke the others. A little horn. And a little horn with a big mouth, if you remember, okay? And he's the one who is saying, I am great. And this is exactly what happens next. This king of the north of the four kingdoms in Greece at that time. And it says, in his place, verse 21, shall come a contemptible person. And we know him as Antiochus Epiphanes. And he says, to whom royal majesty has not been given. See, he was not supposed to be king. His brother was king, so he's just the other brother. Okay? And so he's his brother's king. His brother dies. So who should be king next? His brother's son. But his brother's son is mysteriously killed by the contemptible one, and he takes the throne. So he's not even supposed to be king, but he wrestles that away, and it becomes his. And he'll come in without warning, obtain the kingdom by flatteries. He was a man of great intrigue. Everywhere he went, he would talk people into alliances, break those alliances. He just massaged everything to his benefit. He said, "Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from that time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people." So he had no business having power. And the historians looking at it say, there was just a vacuum of power, and so then he came to this. No, make no mistake. This whole section of the chapter and the last section are not about some kind of mysterious way he came to power. This is how he came to power. Listen to this repetition in the chapter. "Only for a time, to be at the time appointed." At the time appointed. Not be at this time as it was before. "Until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time." Is there getting to be a little repetition in the chapter? I'm not quite done. "And at the time of the end," okay? Now, each one of those are stated very carefully and differently depending on the circumstance, but the point of the chapter really is God has determined the time for when things are going to happen. So, yeah, in one sense, it looks like chaos. Antiochus Epiphanes, he poisons people, he kills people, he comes to power, his small army has amazing success. Matter of fact, they conquer all the way to the fortress of Egypt and plunder the place, but then he withdraws because he can't quite finish the deal and he's grumpy. The chapter says as he comes back through Palestine, he absolutely... Well, it says it this way. It says, "He shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant." What does he do? When he came back through that time and he was set against the holy covenant, he murdered 80,000 Jewish men, women, and children. Can you imagine? A place smaller than Wisconsin, probably less people than Wisconsin at that juncture. 80,000 people just wiped. I mean, these are the people that had come back from Babylon, that God had put in the land, that had been given a temple, and they're worshiping the one true God of heaven and earth. And someone can just walk through and kill 80,000? How do you deal with that as a people? You deal with it because you're told ahead of time that this is what's going to happen. And though it's painful and it's awful, You can begin to put together, okay, God said this is the time, the appointed time, and then there will be a time of the end of these things. You see God's control stamped all over this chapter. Matter of fact, Antiochus Epiphanes raises another army. He goes back to try and finish the deal in Egypt. This is one of my favorite little history stories. So he goes to go back, and unbeknownst to him, because we don't have internet, satellite imagery and other things, okay? He's marching down through across Palestine. He's coming almost to Egypt. And here are the army of Rome. It's called the ships of, is it Kittim? But that's Rome. That's who that is. So Rome has sent an army to back up Egypt. And he gets down there, and the Roman general, Gaius, he says, "Antiochus, let's have a little meeting." They have a meeting. And you see, if you're Antiochus, this would be troubling. See, he'd been in a Roman prison and held for a time before he rose to power. And other parts of his family had been killed and dominated by Rome. And so he knew this is not someone that you mess with lightly. So they come to have conference, and the Roman general walks around him with a sword and draws a circle in the sand all the way around him. And he says, "You have a choice. You stay in your circle, and I'll leave you alone. If you step out of it, all of Rome is going to come down on you." And here is Antiochus. He can see Egypt and its frailty, and he's got the greatest army he's ever had. And he basically says, "Can I step out of the circle to go home? Does that count?" You know what I mean? And he, with his tail tucked between his legs, he goes back to where he was. Now, you can imagine he's on the way back, and what does he have to walk through? Palestine. And is he in a good mood? Not at all. But he's so upset, he goes all, I mean, he literally obeyed. He went all the way back to his kingdom. And then he sent people from his kingdom down to Palestine. And they began to wreck everything. They took over the temple and the fortress around it. And they offered pigs on the altar and did absolute blasphemy in every direction you can imagine. And many of the Jews that did not believe in the one true God sided and submitted to Antiochus and his kingdom. And then there were some, primarily we think of them as the Maccabees as you read things, that began to battle against this. And some even that didn't believe in God joined with them. And they had some success. And eventually, even they were defeated when Rome came into the picture. He is the one who put, as is prophesied here, the abomination that makes desolate. What was desolate? The sacrifice. And I was just reading in Leviticus yesterday. The sacrifice on the altar of the temple that was supposed to always be burning. It was to never go out. Because are you going to need sin sacrifice for every day? What do you think? It's never supposed to go out. Constant feeding of wood to it and sacrifice on top. It's not supposed to go out. This is to honor the one true God, to show absolute submission, to show that I need you. And Antiochus wiped it off. It's like God didn't exist. Can you imagine what that was like for the Jewish people? You might have failed. They might have quit if they hadn't known that this would be true until the time of the end. Matter of fact, look just quickly as we finish verse 35. It says, some of the wise shall stumble. I'm glad that I can be wise and still stumble, don't you? I mean, he's talking about those who believed. He says, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. For it still awaits the appointed time. This is a double little mention about time to help us know, okay, the next thing is not Antiochus. The next king that's talked about is a whole separate section of time that people are being refined for. Look at the last section, and I just label it, and I'm not going to read all of it, even teach all of it, but the last section, verses 36 to the end, are about the Antichrist. Antiochus, remember, pictured that idea of Antichrist and one who exalts himself and does blasphemy against God. But look at verse 36. This king is way worse. Antiochus never fulfilled this to this extent. It says, and the king shall do as he wills, which was spoken of in chapter 9, by the way. It says of the Antichrist, he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. Antiochus still obeyed and worshiped the gods of his youth. This one will magnify himself above every god, speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation or the wrath is accomplished. In other words, this is the one who's going to bring all of time to the end, okay? The one who's going to fill out what the wrath of God is going to come down on. That's what the Antichrist is. There's more that it talks about, how he magnifies himself above all and worships the God of fortresses. This is one of the things that always makes me nervous when Americans say, but our army is so strong. I think, don't ever say that. I just get chills. Like, because that's Antichrist worship, you know? To think that a military is it. Don't ever do that. Because, as it says here, there is a time of the end. And this king who exalts himself, the Antichrist, he's going to put everything together. Matter of fact, he's going to squish the king of the south and totally dominate. And as he does that, he's going to hear that there's those from the north and the east that are coming down to war against him. And he's going to go and meet them headlong. He's going to pitch his tents in the plain. And we know this is the Battle of Armageddon, right? Where it's finished. And as he attacks and he does battle, it says here, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. When I look at this chapter and I try and give in just rapid fire what we're supposed to take away from it, let me try and summarize the main ideas. First of all, I'd say this, God gives comfort in chaos by demonstrating his control. God gives comfort. How does he do that? He does it through his word. It's kind of obvious from the chapter. It's an illustration of that. First, the Bible. This chapter is just one place. I mean, Timothy says it, right? Paul does in Timothy. The Bible is here by inspiration of God. It's God-breathed. But this chapter shows it because, man, it comes true in stunning ways. The Bible is from God. How could Daniel know this stuff? He couldn't. So further, his word, therefore, is true and proven. Someone went through and counted. There are supposedly 135 separate prophetic ideas fulfilled in this chapter. 135 in one chapter. And there are ones that, again, we know came ahead of time, and we can read the history of how they came to be. In other words, as believers, we know because of the Spirit of God that the Word is true. We've seen that ministered in our hearts. But when we look at a chapter like this, and you see all this historical stuff laid out, and it absolutely comes true, I don't know about you, I just kind of go, my chest wants to go out and say, yeah, that's my God. He writes that, it's done. And it makes me move to the next steps, and that is, if his word therefore is true and proven, his truth must be our guide in chaos. So you may find yourself in chaos. You may be shaken at this very moment. Let me tell you, go to God's word. You say, but I don't even know where to look. Go find some other brother or sister right here at Calvary. And if they don't know, they're going to find somebody else. And when we all don't know, we just submit to the Spirit of God and dig in the Word till we can make sense of our chaos. And there are, let me tell you, some passages that give big pictures that help us make sense of chaos. He says the suffering of this world is can't even be compared to the glory that's going to be revealed. Okay? In other words, what we suffer here will make sense when we're in glory. And that's part of what we need to know in chaos. His truth must be our guide in chaos. And chaos is normal on this groan-filled earth. It's just normal. God didn't say, come follow me and life will be easy. No, actually, he said something like, come follow me and you will be hated. He actually said that. You say, you're a downer preacher. You're supposed to celebrate. Okay, I'll celebrate. God said, you're going to be hated. I'm celebrating that because he said it, and it is true. Doesn't that make it? That doesn't shake me. It gives me stability. God says it. It's happened. And it's not like he says you'll be hated and too bad for you. No. He is with us. He says, I'll never leave you in the hatred because you're mine. He says, it groans. He said, all of creation groans. Even the best animal, the most whatever perfect human body on earth has frailties and things that are wrong. And if you think you're past that, live 5 more years. I just dare you. Because then when you get as old as some of us, you understand groan-filled mornings, afternoons, evenings, right? I mean, I got out of bed this morning and I was not trying to fulfill scripture, but I had stomped through deep snow yesterday for fun. I know it's a little messed up here. But for fun, I was out doing that, and I got up in the morning, I'm like, oh, I just groaned. I wasn't even trying to obey God. It just happened, right? Because my legs hurt. That's just all creation groans. And we know that. So don't be shocked by that. Chaos is normal. Think about the Jews. They're getting sent back by Cyrus to build the temple, only to find out that the sacrifice is going to be obliterated off of it. I mean, it seems a little like, why would we do it? Well, we do it because God has said, go do it. And God has said, this is going to happen, but it's not the end of the story either. And that's the next point. Our ultimate end matters most. God keeps telling us, looking unto Jesus, right? Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, right? We need to think about our ultimate end in order to do the groan-filled place we've been put. Our ultimate end matters first. In Romans 8, he says, in the same passage that talked about groaning, he says, it's not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed. He said, it will be revealed. It will be made sense of that which we can't make any sense of today. As humans, we're just never, humanly speaking, thinking about our ultimate end. We think about the now. It's not human to think ultimate end. It's spiritual. And we have to determine to tell ourselves the truth and look toward that. Let me tell you, the fastest way to learn how to look at your ultimate end is to have suffering. You can try and make yourself think that way, and you should, because the Bible tells you to. But suffering forces it. And that's why David said, it's good that I've suffered. It's good that I've suffered. Because now I keep your truth, right? It puts my mind in the right place. We have to keep our mind on the ultimate end. Our soul, even the people around us who mean well, they're going to focus on the here and now. Even their solutions for the hard stuff that happens to us. Like, well, cheer up. This will get better. This is that. This. I'm like, why are they worried about what's happening here? I have been loved by God, and he died on the cross for my sin. He extended to me as a personal gift. I have trusted that. Therefore, I am kept for the hope of glory. I don't need anything else on this earth. Amen? And God graciously gives us many things, but do not hold tightly to them. Love most the ultimate place and relationship that he's made us for. Our ultimate end. Evil, because if the ultimate end is good and true, and God deserts us or doesn't deal with evil, it would be loony to care about the ultimate end. But understand, this passage tells us evil in all its forms has an ultimate end. It's going to be defeated. And that's important. Otherwise, we've just been abused on earth. But evil will be destroyed, even as the Antichrist is pictured in this chapter. And lastly, God sustains us on the way. You say, where's the verse in this chapter that says that? It doesn't say it. It just is it. You know what I mean? The chapter is there as God's way of saying, I will sustain you. See how it's going to unfold. See how my word comes true. And there's a little more to Daniel, so come back. And see what I have promised and how I'm finishing this. And then you'll be able to remain and endure. If you'd pray with me. Lord, I pray that we'd be people that look at the ultimate end and not at the day. That we would just live today submitted to you. And Lord, I know there's people here who are in chaos and they don't see this hope. They can't find it in the tangle. I pray that you would just direct them to you and to those who love you so they could have the truth that can make this make sense, that can enable them to endure and have hope that is never put to shame. And Lord, may we be your people who live in that hope of your promise so that others can see it in Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Lord, thank you for loving us with truth so that we are not shaken in this world, but established and full of courage. May we do that together. In Jesus' name, amen.